Hello and welcome to our latest edition of the ALS Association podcast. I'm Tony Heil, the Communication and Public Policy Director here at the ALS Association Greater Philadelphia Chapter. In the past few podcasts, we've talked to researchers, Walk to Defeat ALS captains, and board members here at the chapter. And today I'm very excited to bring you Board Chair Jeff Abrams, who's been working with the Greater Philadelphia Chapter for over three decades in various capacities to help support patient care and research. Jeff has been a huge component of why the Greater Philadelphia Chapter has been able to expand and help many people. Currently, 850 people with ALS are working with our chapter, and we're really excited about what him and his family and his extended family have been able to do for our cause. Before we start, ALS Awareness Month is coming up in May. You can get involved in a lot of awareness activities at www.alsphiladelphia.org. Go there to participate in a walk to defeat ALS, donate, and advocate. There's lots of ways you can get involved. There's no reason not to. It takes very little time to find a way to do it. If you want to learn more, like I said, go to our website. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, and anything else at ALS Philadelphia. And you can always email me, tony@alsphiladelphia.org. Like I said, our guest today is Jeff Abrams. And Jeff, thanks for being here to participate in our podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been three decades that you've been involved with the ALS Association. Is this podcast moment the pinnacle of that, or have there been other high points in between?
It is, and as you can tell, I started with the chapter when I was 2.5 years old, which is why I was able to spend the last 30 years being involved.
It's amazing what you were able to do at such a young age.
It really is, but it's a testament really to hard work and very creative mathematics.
Right. But seriously, when you started, it was because of your father. And you were in your 20s, right?
Yes. In fact, my father was diagnosed, Howard Abrams was his name. He was diagnosed in 1981, and I was in college. I'm sorry, I was in graduate school at the time, living in Washington, D.C. And so many ALS patients have strange and circuitous paths to their diagnosis, as we know. And in my dad's case, he and my mother were at a party, and they were dancing, and he tripped and sustained a really significant injury to his left ankle. And for a guy who was so athletic and so fit and in his early 50s, his doctor thought that was very strange and he shouldn't have been as injured as he was. And that set him on a path of seeing specialists, including neurologists, who eventually realized that what was at work was ALS.
That's an interesting story with dancing, because we know Tuesdays with Maury was dancing, and then I just saw for the first time finally Theory of Everything, and dancing was a component to Stephen Hawking. And like you said, it's something that people aren't going to think about. But obviously that happened nearly 35 years ago now, not to make you feel even older. But that leaves such an impact for any person touched by the disease.
Well, it does. It was devastating to my parents. Both my sister and I, my sister was 3 years older than I am, were out of the house and starting on our own personal and professional journeys. And it was really sort of the golden time for my parents. They were both in their early 50s. My dad was sort of at the height of his professional success. And what they were staring at was something that was going to fundamentally change both their lives and gradually rob them of the things about their lives that they were looking forward to, which was growing old together. Mm-hmm. The coincidence that brought my family to the Greater Philadelphia Chapter was that one of the specialists that my father visited was up at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he and my mother went up there to spend a weekend and have some tests and some consulting. And in a waiting room, one morning, they met the Charlesteins, Morton and Malvina Charlestein, the parents of our chapter president, Ellen Phillips, and the father-in-law of Ellen's husband, Alan, who was at the same time being seen by the same neurologist in the same hospital. And from that point forward, a friendship and a working relationship was formed that brought our family into the ALS Philadelphia chapter family itself.
And the chapter was pretty small at that time in the early 80s.
Ellen is fond of saying that at that time the chapter was operated out of a shoebox. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's hyperbole. I think it really was operated out of a shoebox containing a bunch of important 3x5 cards with names, addresses, and donation amounts. And, of course, since then, much has changed. In many, many ways, except we still don't have any more of a cure or a treatment today than we had 35 years ago when the Charlesians and the Abrams met in Boston.
But there is a little bit more hope since then. Since you started, the chapter's grown. I'm looking behind you at our map of the chapter, and obviously we weren't taking care of all of that geography at the time. The Phillies hadn't gotten involved at that point yet, though they would very soon. And there's been a lot of great research since then. So how are things different from 1981, 85 to 2015, where we are today?
Well, certainly the absence of a cure does not mean the absence of hope or help. And while so much has been going on in the research side and the clinical side, about which I am certainly not an expert, over these past three decades, in the other area of importance, the chapter and the ALS Association nationwide has been paying a lot of attention to the care and well-being of patients and families. As you said, we in this chapter now provide service and support to over 800 families in an ever-growing geographical area. The range of services that are provided now are much wider and much deeper than we could have even imagined 35 years ago. One of our pet projects, my family's pet projects, is the in-home care program, which was sort of the brainchild of my dad in 1992-93, and Ellen Phillips, who wanted to together find a way that people could do what my dad was doing, which was spend as much time for as long as possible in the comfort and care of their own home before ALS took them so far down the path that they had to relocate to some sort of support facility, long-term care facility or hospital. And what they put together is now today known as the Howard Abrams In-Home Care Program. And it provides support with a number of different daily aspects of living for several hours per week to patients and families so that life at home can be a little bit easier and can be enjoyed for hopefully a lot longer than it would have without those services in place.
That's something that for me was important when I learned about the chapter. My grandfather passed away from ALS in 2007, and he didn't have the in-home care program where he was at. And where he is in Western Pennsylvania, he just wasn't clued in with that chapter as much. And they do great work at the Western Pennsylvania chapter. But then when I heard about what happens here and what you've been able to do for now 20 years with the program, is like, that's what I want. Because you're treating people not just as a person who needs help at a hospital, but as a human being.
It's nice of you to use the word you when referring to it. I have to confess that my involvement with the program itself is minuscule compared to all of the frontline people who are out there every day providing unbelievable compassionate care to our patients and our families. But it has been a challenge and a privilege to watch it grow into the kind of thing that I know you wish your grandfather had. Out in Western Pennsylvania, available to him. It's also become a model, not only in the national ALS community, but in many other neurodegenerative, neuromuscular disease communities across the country. They look at this program and they say, you know, this is an important piece of a bigger clinical picture, and we'd like to see if we can help families get something like this in our community, because it really does help the rest of the puzzle pieces fit together.
So I want to take a veer off on that, because I work with Wendy Barnes, who helps coordinate the program here. She does an amazing job.
Yes, she does.
Going into the details. But my grandmother had Parkinson's disease on my other side of the family. We have too many diseases in our family. But it is one of those things where I look at what we do and know that not only are we helping people with ALS, but I'm sure you've seen this, that maybe our ideas can help with other diseases as well. So by funding our programs, you're almost funding an idea factory for all sorts of neuromuscular diseases.
We've seen that kind of, and I use this term in a complimentary fashion, copycat behavior happening more and more across many different medical and patient communities. And it's a good thing, because if an idea takes hold and it helps people in one community with one particular medical challenge, then if it can be translated to other communities and other diseases, then all the better. Another great example of that from our chapter standpoint, as you know, is our assistive and adaptive technologies, which in our chapter, which is run so well by Elisa Brownlee, services our patients directly on a very hands-on and responsive and flexible fashion, so that as needs change and increase, services and the technologies and the physical hardware that we can provide are adjusted and adapted to meet that patient's changing needs. Well, that is also a model that has been picked up, and in fact, Elisa from our chapter, I know, is considered an expert across the neuromuscular disease community, because the kinds of technologies that are so important and so useful to ALS patients and to their families are also very useful to people with MS, to people with muscular dystrophy, to people with other advancing and progressive neuromuscular diseases. And it's nice to be able to have that kind of cascading beneficial effect out there in the wider world, while we also pay close attention to the needs of our own patients.
Yeah, it's really neat to me. When my grandfather passed away, he couldn't use the technology we have, not because there wasn't a chapter to provide it, because it didn't exist yet. And I'm sure, obviously, those things did not exist for your father. And, you know, the iPad, for example, that was something that was so futuristic 20 years ago. And now it's something that we're like, well, let's see what we can do to make sure everyone has communication.
That's a great example, and one of only several, or only one of several, I should say. But my father had a first-generation eye gaze computer apparatus. We're talking 1992, 93, something like that. And what that consisted of was a full-sized PC, probably a 386 processor, and a big monitor and a camera that looked at his eyeball and went through a very protracted kind of calibration process, so that he could type out at a snail's pace enough words that could make him feel like he was communicating in real time with real people around him. Don't get me wrong, even though the technology was primitive and we would look at it now the way we would look at a steam engine, it nonetheless was incredibly helpful to him, because it really created a bridge back into the world that he was slowly leaving in terms of communication. To talk about what the iPad has done these days and the modernization of this kind of communication technology is the same as standing on the Earth in 1947 and imagining that somebody might someday walk on the moon. I mean, that is how huge the gap is. And our patients really, really, really benefit, and their families benefit from something that we take for granted, which is communication in real time. The ability to share thoughts, emotions, requests, laughter, stories with one another in a two-way fashion. It makes an incredible difference in their lives. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of these technologies to go around. We're doing a good job keeping our patients armed with them, but in the wider world out there, for all sorts of reasons in the medical reimbursement arena and things like that, not everybody who needs this kind of technology is getting it. So we're hoping that we're doing a good job helping fill some of those gaps, because it really makes an unbelievable difference to someone's life.
Well, and that, like you said, on speech-generating devices is one of the reasons why people should get involved with advocacy, especially this year. There's legislation, the Steve Gleason Act. Obviously, you're very aware of Steve Gleason, and a lot of people listening here should be. But when I was in Washington just a little over a week ago, 2 weeks ago now, people there didn't even know about him necessarily, the staff people I met with, but they knew about ALS. And there are changes in Medicare that make it harder for people to own their own device. So if you're listening, get involved with advocacy. Go to alsa.org/advocacy and join us for Advocacy Day in May, and from May 10th to May 12th. Or if you want to get involved locally, you can email me, tony@alsphiladelphia.org. Jeff, you've been involved in advocacy for many years, in many fashions. And you've seen it sometimes be frustrating, I know, but oftentimes it's led to positive results. And some of this, what we've done, has led to some positive results with legislators actually listening, right?
Absolutely. The advocacy, we call it Advocacy Week. It actually turns out to be about 4 days every year in May in Washington, brings together ALS families, patients, researchers, clinicians, caregivers, advocates, all in Washington, D.C. for a full day on the Hill of talking real time with legislators and their staffers about current important issues that need to get moved forward at a governmental level. It also brings them together in conference fashion so we can get prepped for those issues and learn a lot about them. And they have been incredibly successful, those advocacy sessions, and the ongoing advocacy that goes on throughout the year, not just in May in Washington, have been incredibly successful on very important issues, all of which I know you're familiar with. For example...
Right, this isn't a quiz.
Right. The creation of the ALS Registry,
mm-hmm.
Which is a national database, an authoritative database that's maintained by the ATSDR, which is a division of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and is the only nationwide registry for information, patient information, biological, chemical, medical, technical information about patients that is submitted to this national registry. And it will provide the basis, a database basis for a lot of research going forward. And that was an initiative that grew out of the advocacy efforts on Capitol Hill because it receives a fair amount of funding from the federal government. It did for its startup and for its maintenance. The Defense Department has heightened awareness of and assistance, budgetary assistance in ALS care because ALS occurs at twice the rate in the armed services than it does in the general population.
My grandfather was a veteran.
As was mine.
Yeah. And
or my father was.
Right.
And they don't know what that link is, but they know that link is significant enough that the Department of Defense maintains a couple of very important initiatives that are funded on a year-to-year basis, which is why we keep going back and asking them to make sure they re-up it for the coming year, to pay close attention both on a research and a clinical side, to the service-specific incidents of ALS. That came directly from the advocacy efforts, both nationwide and in Washington. And there are others. There's a presumptive disability status for ALS patients, so they don't have to wait the waiting period, which can be catastrophic for someone who has a very fast-moving neuromuscular disease like this. That came from advocacy.
With Social Security. I was actually at an event this weekend, and I was talking to someone who worked in Social Security, which that never happens to me. And I said where I worked, and he said, oh, you're one of only two diseases that have this thing.
That's right.
And I was really happy about the fact that he knew that, because I'm sure he doesn't get in touch with a lot of ALS families.
The presumptive disability status with SSI or SSDI was, to me, an example, to a lot of us, an example of a real connection between a need and a policy change in Washington, because it wasn't the product of some backroom negotiation that got somebody's pet cause a line item in a budget. It was the realization that that timeline, that waiting period for disability under Social Security for a disease like ALS can have unbelievable impact, bad impact on patients and families because this disease moves at times so quickly and in such catastrophically debilitating ways that to wait is to lose ground every day. Mm-hmm. And somebody actually saw that. Somebody in the government actually saw that and said, you know, this doesn't make sense. We need to fix this in a logical way. Well, that was because they heard the voices of people who were coming down from the ALS community and advocating for how important this was.
And you said the right words with ALS community, because while it's important that people with ALS get involved, it's obviously our work is about the whole family and the whole ALS community. We have certain advocates who did it because they have ALS, or their spouse, or their mother, or their father, or a friend, or a coworker. People get involved with all sorts of ways. So we talk about serving 850 people with ALS, but that number is a lot bigger than that in terms of who we're connecting with and supporting.
Sure, and that's just our chapter. I mean, across the country at any given time, the incidence is somewhere between, 30 and 40,000 people, and I think I have those numbers close to right. And I've had some interesting conversations with people at various types of ALS-related events about why they're involved. And it's easy to see why a patient's family, loved ones, workers, other members of their close-in support community might be involved. And it's easy to see why clinicians and researchers who have had a dedicated track record in ALS would be interested. But I've, as recently as a month ago, had a conversation with a neurologist who has no connection to ALS whatsoever, but may be attending in Washington and has helped out in some other ways. And I asked her, what is it, you know, that attracts you to this? And she said, you know, a lot of us, particularly in the medical research arena, know that if we're doing good, solid research on one disease, we're probably doing something that's going to help a lot of other people who have a lot of other diseases. Mm-hmm. And particularly in neurology, people who are studying ALS and making advances both in basic and translational relational sciences are probably going to be impacting favorably people who have Parkinson's, people who have muscular dystrophy, people who have muscular or multiple sclerosis, because there are interrelated aspects of all these things. So the sum of the advocacy is greater than its component parts. When we are down in Washington or in Harrisburg or elsewhere advancing the cause of ALS research and care, we know, benefiting more than just those who are in our immediate community, because this science is going to take the lives of people with neuromuscular diseases a lot further than if we were just paying attention to just one disease.
Yeah, I know that Jill Yersak, who lives in New Jersey, she was at Hot Chocolate. She was the one saying exactly the same thing. And she's coming to Washington with us this year. It's her first time going to advocacy. And it is really interesting how people who are researchers or clinicians who they don't have ALS in their background, but the disease makes such an impact on people once they deal with it. Have you noticed that from your beginning with this to now, or is it a lot greater now that people have seen videos? Because now, in addition to what video did with the Ice Bucket Challenge, it also was able to allow people to see ALS in a way they couldn't before. So is it a lot different now how people connect?
Well, you're talking to a guy who's closer to 60 than he is to 50, so I'm not exactly...
Well, that's only a 10-year window there.
But I'm not exactly on the cutting edge of social media and its impact the way my kids are. Mm-hmm. But it's impossible, no matter how distant you are from modern technology, to not be impressed by how much more we know about everything. And I mean everything, capital E, than we knew 20 years ago. We have seen the benefit of that in the ALS community, in particular in the last year, because of the unbelievable, explosive, viral power of the Ice Bucket Challenge. I mean, this is it's a case study in global electronic crowdfunding and marketing, except it's so new that there are no case studies on it. We're still in the middle of learning the impact of something like the Ice Bucket Challenge.
And during it, I was sharing something on Facebook, and my friend at National said, oh, did you guys come up with that? No, did you? Like, it was just so organic. We didn't even know who was doing something.
And that's why I say we're in the middle of it, so we do know a few things. We do know that awareness of ALS has not only grown exponentially, but has grown from a different direction that we never anticipated. We, like so many nonprofits, so many cause-related organizations, have spent our history growing outward organically from the inside. This was something that sort of came at us from another direction. Now, the people who were the originators were within the ALS community, but they were young people who saw a media platform that had not been explored or exploited for this reason and took off with it. So much of that awareness, and frankly, so many of those dollars, came from people who had never heard of ALS before. What they were aware of was social media and Facebook and cool things to do, a new level of sort of participatory involvement that felt more meaningful to them than just writing a check or just giving a credit card number over the phone. This was something that was cool and it had cachet, and it made them feel like, particularly for the 5 seconds that they were shivering under a torrent of ice water, like they were really involved in doing something that was meaningful and also came directly from them. It is unlike anything that we've seen in the nonprofit world. And when I started my involvement with ALS, what I knew was Lou Gehrig. I knew, my generation knew, and certainly the generations older than me, knew that Lou Gehrig died of some mysterious neurological disease, and it had a name that you couldn't pronounce. But other than that, in the popular world, we really didn't know much else about that. Look at what's going on now. Eddie Redmayne wins an Oscar for portraying an ALS patient and portraying it well, and stands up and gives his acceptance speech and talks about ALS, and the audience that's listening doesn't have to have its learning curve shortened. Mm-hmm. They know what it is. It's out there in the public consciousness.
Because those celebrities in the audience were doing it too.
Absolutely. So it's a long answer to your short question, which is how have things changed? In part, we don't know yet how they've changed because they're still changing. But the public awareness, the public consciousness, and the public willingness to become advocates in their own right is completely different from what it was when I started out. And it's just going to continue to grow. And the benefits, obviously, we're seeing the benefits in terms of the kind of money we can spend on research and the kind of money we can spend taking care of patients. And we will see the crowning benefit when all of those millions of people who poured ice water on their heads and wrote a check will share in the victory when we come up with a cure for this thing, because that's how it's going to happen. It's going to happen in the modern day through modern technology as a result of modern consciousness and awareness.
Right. And just like there was the urgency of you got to match that challenge in a day, we have that urgency of we all want to be out of doing this by tomorrow as well. But in addition to that, there's videos in terms of fundraising. Has the deep personal connection to the disease changed since you started? Like, for instance, like you were saying that there are people who don't have their own personal connection who get involved, even if it's a loose connection. Was it the same 20 and 30 years ago? Or like, has it been easier for people to get emotionally attached to the disease than ever before, regardless of any ice bucket thing, just because of technology and awareness?
I think it is easier. And I'll sort of turn the answer on its head. It's less hard.
Mm-hmm. Which isn't
always the same as easier.
Yes.
When my dad was diagnosed in 81, and as he progressed to becoming completely debilitated by 87, people who would see him in a wheelchair connected to a ventilator that was doing his breathing would have no idea what was going on. They could speculate a little bit, maybe a traumatic spinal injury or something like that. But if you said to them, he has ALS, people would have no recognition of what that was. And it's uncomfortable. As compassionate humans, we don't like to see our fellow humans suffer. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult for people to get in there and relate personally to a patient who is that debilitated, who does not communicate, who's fully intact and is a fully realized human being but is trapped in a failing body. It's very, very difficult for people to get in close enough to that, to develop that personal connection. So that is always a challenge in the early years. One of the brilliant things that this chapter and the people who, like yourself, who were involved in the outreach of this chapter have done for three generations is to humanize the patient and family experience so that more and more people who don't have a personal connection to ALS can find their way into a connection and can find their way to understand and identify with and support those people who are battling so courageously with this disease. That's easier now. It's less hard now.
Yeah.
It's not a foreign kind of experience for people to say, oh, I see that person. I understand that person has ALS. That's like fill in the names here. We've had such an awareness of it because tragically so many people in the public eye have battled the disease, but there were prominent people with ALS a long time ago, Gehrig being the best example. But we didn't have the media platforms, we didn't have the internet, the social media, the instant news cycle to get that information out there. And as in any other endeavor, information is a great playing field leveler. So people can have a person, they can approach a personal connection because they can first learn what things are about and not be afraid of them, and then find a way into a personal connection that they can identify with. And the next time they meet an ALS patient or a family, they won't be talking across a grand divide. They'll have a more intimate connection and understanding of what that person's going through.
Yeah, I know. When I was in Washington, talking to a lot of people who don't know what ALS is, maybe it's their first time working in D.C., so they've never met us before, because there's a lot of new members of Congress every time we go. I was able to take my smartphone this time and say, oh, I just want to show you a video of someone who couldn't make it. Like, here's someone who's renewing his vows with his eye gaze technology. This is why it's important. Here's a video of this thing. And so that's something you couldn't do 5, 10 years ago, much less 20 or 30 years ago.
No, it's a game change. It's a complete game change.
And that's, again, for every disease, not just ALS.
Right. And, you know, we've been, you shy away from using the word lucky in a context like this, but we have had the ironic good fortune that in the past few years, a few things that have happened to bubble ALS up to the top of the public awareness sphere, you know, with the theory of everything, with the ice bucket challenge, with the 100th anniversary of Lou Gehrig's birth, with the
Steve Gleason,
with other athletes, celebrities, public officials,
OJ Brigance from the Ravens,
you know, the list can go on. Mike Porcaro, the bassist, won't talk about being old, the bassist for Toto, the quintessential 1980s pop group.
I remember they were played at my wedding.
Oh, yeah. You should, they personally paid?
On a record,
which is a whole other technology that goes back. But Mike Porcaro, a wonderful musician, died last week from ALS. He stopped touring 10 years ago.
Actually done music for Michael Jackson and a number of other major people that people would not have known
about. Yeah, hey, that group, that team of musicians that made up Toto was a bunch of crack studio musicians who had worked that circuit for years. And people like that, like Mike Porcaro, had connections in the entertainment industry too, which helped get his message out. They raised a lot of money on his behalf out west. And so, like I said, I hasten to use the word lucky, but sometimes things happen for a reason, and there is a high awareness of ALS from several different vantage points that is helping us keep this advocacy ball rolling. It's our job to make sure that it continues, even as the names and faces of some of these folks start to recede into a little bit of fuzzy memory.
Well, one of those faces that has stayed kind of consistent, in addition to you and Ellen Phillips, is the Phillies. Obviously, you've been around with that for a while, and we had the Phillies Festival coming up in May this year. It's the 31st year that we've been with the Phillies. Last year we celebrated the 30th anniversary working with them, and over $15.2 million raised since the start. But you were there when it was like, just, well, let's see what happens, to like exponential growth. But the commitment really just got stronger and stronger and stronger every year. So how has that helped, and was that relationship essential to why everything helped to take off, so that there was a base of support once the Ice Bucket Challenge happened? Because it wasn't like, when the Ice Bucket Challenge happened, there wasn't like a vacuum, like, oh, what are we going to do? There was something here that people could latch onto.
I can't.
If that makes sense.
I can certainly not claim any significant role in the formation of the Phillies' relationship with our chapter, but I have been lucky enough to work somewhat closely with those people who maintain that relationship, and I know a lot about the history. I was there at the first Phillies Wives event. We, as you know, started out our relationship not with the Phillies organization directly, but with the Phillies Wives players had an organization that did a lot of activities for various social causes. And Bill Giles had the genius to say to Ellen Phillips, you get the Phillies Wives, you'll get the players, you'll get the rest of the organization. Start there. And that was the let's see what happens element that you referenced before. It started out with a small fashion show at one of the hotels, I think on City Line Avenue, 30-some-odd years ago, and has grown into a partnership that is both the model for and the envy of the nonprofit world. There is no other sports team charity partnership in the country like this one. I can say that without fear of contradiction. The leadership of the Phillies organization is the anchor of that commitment. The Giles family really got us cemented, and the rest of the leadership, the Montgomerys, and the top tier of the Phillies organization, got that relationship going, and then brought the players and everyone else along. And the players have been unbelievably supportive for a number of years. Curt Schilling was so involved. Mickey Morandini was so involved.
And still involved.
And still are. And to make that kind of commitment when what you need to really do is concentrate on going out and throwing strikes or hitting a ball, when your real, you know, first level of responsibility is to advance your team, to take the time and make that kind of commitment to people that you've really never met before, who have a disease with which you are really not all that familiar, was astonishing. And the Phillies Festival is the perfect example of that. All the players are there. All the managers are there. The leadership is there. You go from place to place to place talking to your heroes, your baseball heroes, getting them to sign a baseball or a cap for you, knowing all the time that they are out there because this event helps raise money, awareness, and relationships to support ALS. And it's really an astounding event, and one that's unlike anything else in Major League sports and in the nonprofit world.
Well, and in my opinion, if it weren't for those 30 years of getting to the point where the chapter grew, if the Ice Bucket Challenge had happened and blew up the ALS cause, and Steve Gleason blew the ALS cause up, then when people came to donate, there wouldn't be something to donate to. I mean, there might be an ALS association, but we wouldn't have the assistive technology program. You know, the Howard I. Abrams in-home care program might be a lot smaller. So it helps so that when the next thing happens, there's a base of support so the programs could be there. Because if you're giving money to something and saying, well, what am I giving money to?
Well, we are, for better or worse, a going concern because we have been in business to serve our patients for a long, long time. And as a result, this chapter and the organization nationwide has a robust set of services and programs that it funds. And you're absolutely right. When the Ice Bucket Challenge happened, or any of the other, we don't want to concentrate solely on Ice Bucket, although it's still the biggest of the phenomena. When other events happen where people decide they want to support us, they can do so being confident that there is an operation that has been doing this for a long time that is going to gratefully and thankfully accept their donation and their support and put it to work right away, rendering important services to patients and families, funding important research that will one day bring around a cure. It's not like we're putting it in a bucket someplace and trying to figure out what to do with it later.
Yeah, I mean, we've had conversations here where our grant, someone will get a new grant from somewhere, or Jim, our executive director, will find out, oh, we're going to get this kind of funding, you know, and talk to Brenda Edelman, our director of patient services. I'll say, well, you know, if we get X amount of dollars, is there a way to use it? Just like, I know exactly what we can do. We can fund this clinic service. We can do this. She knows off the top of her head the kind of people that need help right away, which is really exciting because there's a lot of good people like her that would think that way, but you know, you don't know, not everyone in the world could be the kind of gem that can just think off the top of their head, I know where a need is with a person with ALS, get it there in an hour.
And a lot of that comes from the fact that this organization is just filled with smart, hardworking people, and a lot of it also comes from the fact that these smart, hardworking people have been doing this for a while.
Yeah, Brenda didn't start yesterday.
Yeah, and getting really, really deep into an understanding of your patient and family's community's needs, being able to understand them to a level that you can quickly prioritize them and say, oh, I know this person, this family, this community needs this, whereas someone over here needs something different, and be able to do that quickly, efficiently, cost efficiently, which is a very important thing, not waste money when you're doing these kinds of things, and be responsive quickly to families and patients who need people to be people and services on the scene quickly, is an irreplaceable skill, and it is an asset that we are proud to have and a range of services that we are constantly seeking to improve and to make better, to make faster, to make more efficient. And I think so far that those smart, hardworking people I talked about before are doing a very good job of all that.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think everyone else here does too, and hopefully our patient families do as well. But you were talking about all the people, and you had mentioned about humanizing this disease that can be very hard for people to understand. And so I want to circle back as we finish this. I think, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, but I think the in-home care program is one of those things that can humanize this disease, because people can understand, I want to have, like, if my wife, God forbid, had a terminal illness, I would want her in my home as long as possible. That's something that you can get that humanizes this disease. Do you think that this program, which has existed for 20 years now, has been at the forefront or been essential to that aspect of what our chapter represents in terms of not just being clinical, you know, not just being about numbers, but about making sure people understand the humanity of ALS and what it helps the families?
The answer to that is yes, but I don't pretend to be the one who's smart enough to give you an authoritative answer on that. What we know are the stories from patients like Heather Hildebrand, who tell us all the time the value, the critical, important value of the in-home care services that she and her family are receiving. And we know just from that kind of feedback the value and the absolute necessity to continue to bring that kind of value to patients like her and families like hers. There is also, I'm sure, data out there, although I can't profess to have it at my fingertips, that says that people with these kinds of debilitating diseases who can, in fact, live in their own home, around their loved ones, in a familiar environment for as long as possible, live longer, live better, probably live happier for a longer period of time. And that was really the seed that led my dad to want to talk to Ellen about the idea of coming up with and helping fund a program that could do this, because he lived at home. Mm-hmm. And he, with great support, round-the-clock support, in fact, and he was able, he believed, for a longer time to have a better quality of life, to remain healthier, which is a word you don't usually, you know, hear yourself using in this context, for much longer, because he was in an environment where he was surrounded by familiar things, people, faces, voices. And when he needed to leave to go get acute medical care, he could, but he returned to his house. We want to help people do that to the greatest extent that we can, because at the end of the day, it is a very human impact. It is a lifestyle impact. Your life is changing because of this disease. How can we help you and your family keep things as close to normal for as long as possible? That's the question we ask ourselves every day when we think of new ways that this program can help people stay at home a little bit longer, have the peace, the serenity, the love, and the well-being that comes with being in a home a little bit longer. Because that really is, in my mind anyway, the most important of human virtues.
And Heather is someone that means a lot to me, even though I've only met her a few times. You know, because you were involved with the appeal that we did this year. She was diagnosed with ALS, having symptoms while she was pregnant. That's something I can't, it's almost impossible to deal with. But it's got to be, I don't want to say good, because it's not. You don't want to hear about any patient, but every year you meet a new family that's using this program that your dad made possible, and that you and your wife have helped continue, and then all the other donors. So do you feel even stronger attachment because of this? I mean, I don't think your attachment can get much stronger, obviously, but what's that like, having those personal connections when it comes to the program that's intertwined with your family name?
I meet several families every year who are new to the program and who are uncontained in their praise for it and their gratitude for it. And I, you know, fortunately, that praise and gratitude is directed where it should be, which is to the patient care services people here at the chapter and other professionals with whom we work. But it is also a point of some personal pride, lowercase p, because I can think back to the fact that, you know, my old man sort of made this happen. Margaret and I are very happy and proud to help do it, but we take no credit for the innovative thought and the creative energy that my dad really brought to bear with this. And, you know, he was smart enough to talk to Ellen about it, who right away grabbed onto it and came up with great detailed ideas for how it could be implemented, and the program took off and has grown from there.
Yeah, don't tell Ellen a good idea unless you're prepared for it to happen.
Absolutely right. And unless you're prepared to work with her closely and take calls 24/7 until it gets done, which they had a great partnership on this, and it was a point of great affection for my dad that he was able to work with Ellen and the staff so closely on getting this implemented. He came up with and helped fund the idea only 3 years before he died, so he never actually saw the program itself get to the kind of operating force and power that it has today. But he knew. He was a smart guy. And he knew he was working with smart people, and he knew that it would get there eventually, and that his experience was providing the kind of model that he was hoping the chapter could help other families achieve through these kinds of services. It's the other thing it is, besides being a point of some personal pride, it's also humbling. It's really you meet people who I mean, I could be the biggest whining crybaby in the world, and about the most minor of things, like how the Eagles or Phillies or Flyers or Sixers are playing. But you meet people who are facing unbelievable odds, whose families have been disrupted by a disease that, as you point out in Heather's case, is a non-discriminating attacker. It will hit people at the worst times of their lives, like when they're pregnant. And you can see them stare back at this thing and say, all right, I got this. You know, this is changing my life. This is changing my family's life. But it's not going to take 1 ounce of life away from me without me fighting hard back against it. That's humbling. That's a life lesson. And I get out of it so much more from that kind of experience than I could ever claim to put into it.
Well, that's great, and I'm glad that you and our chapter staff, Wendy Barnes, Brenda, and others who work on the program are able to bring that humanity to the disease. So we're going to continue doing this, not the podcast itself, but continue working on these efforts, working towards the Phillies Festival. If you're inspired to get involved with the Howard I. Abrams In-Home Care Program and donate, you can go to www.alsphiladelphia.org/abrams. Very easy to donate online. But if you want to participate, advocate, or donate in any way, go to alsphiladelphia.org. You can also, of course, participate in a Walk to Defeat ALS, www.gpcwalktodefeatals.org. That's GPC for Greater Philadelphia Chapter. And follow us on all social media channels possible at alsphiladelphia.org. Jeff is following us on all of them, of course.
Is MySpace still a thing, or is that...
I don't think so. You might get a Yahoo GeoCities page. But I appreciate you sharing your story and your perspective. So thank you, Jeff, for being part of this today.
Thanks for asking me, Tony.